RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So, to the data revealed in an OIA submitted by Ali Cook concerning the numbers of young people presenting with heart pain and the newly released myocarditis / pericarditis study. Many of you have been talking about this in the last few days. So we thought it was time to invite a few people on to RCR to talk about this. First up, the woman who got those OIA requests in and the answers back, musician, activist and mother, Ali Cook. Hi, Ali. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Paul. Nice to be on chatting.
Nice to have you too. Linda Wharton of the Health Forum New Zealand is back on RCR. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me back.
Good to have you back. And everybody's favourite doctor, Guy Hatchard of the Hatchard Report. Morning, Guy. Thanks for coming on.
Great to see you, Paul. Great to see Ali and Linda.
Okay. I'll start with you, Ali. Tell us about the OIAs, what those questions were, and what you got back. Let's start there.
Yeah, so many of the listeners will know I have a vaccine-injured son. He has a diagnosis of vaccine-induced pericarditis. And he had actually come out of a cardiology appointment. And he said, Mum, you're not going to believe this. So I walked out of the cardiology appointment and at the hospital, they had it at the hospital, even though it was private. And there's about 60 people in that room, it takes about 60 people. It's a big room. And he said, Mum, every single person in there was my age or younger. He said, there wasn't a fat person or an old person in sight, Mum. And I said, wow. And that sort of made me think, what was a sort of innocuous question that I could ask that wasn't pointing at vaccination? But I thought, yeah, okay, I'll just ask the number of admissions under 40 into the ED departments for chest pain, any kind of chest pain. And the other question I wanted answered was around ambulances, because my son, when the initial vaccine happened and he was in an ambulance, taken by ambulance from his class 5 truck, which he drives, he never got a bill. And he said he spoke to another friend who was taken away by ambulance as well, and they said they never got a bill. Now, we always get a bill when you have an ambulance. You always get a bill from St. John's, and one never arrived. And it was Healthline that had called that ambulance for him. When you got vaccinated, you got given a little Healthline pamphlet. You have any issues? Call Healthline. So that's what he did. And so I was trying to find out as well the data on those ambulances, but they didn't come back with that answer. So based on the answers I got back, I've gone back now with more questions. So I've gone back with a cut down of age groups, so 12 to 18, 18 to 24, 25 to 30, 30 to 40, to ask them the data on that, on the number of admissions. And I've gone back on the financials on the ambulance. So I've gone back and asked, what is the cost of Healthline ambulances for these years, because they wouldn't give me the number of call-outs, because I feel like they're kind of pushing that under somehow. And I also asked some more questions on the myocarditis, pericarditis, because the figures they gave don't even match what's at ACC and don't match other figures that we now know. And then the report has come out, of course, which Linda will talk about. But, yeah, so that was my reasons for the OIA, and then I've gone back with more questions on that OIA.
On the ambulance, so working this one out, so if there was no charge, then it kind of must be related to the harm incidents. Is that what zeroes in on that? Because I imagine if it was anyone else with a regular thing, let's say, they would have been charged.
Absolutely. When you get an ambulance, you normally pay a minimal fee of about $90, I think it is.
I know, I've done it.
Yeah.
I've done it, I know.
Yeah. So I'm just wanting to find out.
Took them a while to get the money from me, but there you go.
Yeah, but they never got bills. Those that got, and the funny thing was, like over a year later, he had another incident in the truck with his chest, with his vaccine injury, and an ambulance got called and drove him from Murchison to Nelson Hospital, and again, he never got a bill. So the costs for those ambulances and the details on those ambulances are somewhere. So that's my mission, is to find where that data is, or get the right question framed in the right way to get an answer on it. Yeah.
That's so interesting you say that, unrelated, but to an interview we had just a day or so ago, and that was that companies who had had an arrangement with the government to get their staff vaccinated had created a separate category of sick leave, which was funded differently. So
yeah.
Pattern recognition, you know, maybe there's something there. Okay, and just for the listeners, when was your son injured? When did he turn up to the hospital? How far back was that?
So he was the 20th of January 2022. He was very late to get the vaccine. He was mandated. So that was the date of the vaccine. And then he was in A&E the next day, the day after that in a separate hospital, and the day after that in a separate hospital. And that's an interesting thing now that's actually happened, is that we found that the ECGs went missing from three hospitals. Three separate hospitals lost his ECGs and his blood results. And I've got one investigation underway at Christchurch Hospital. They've not been able to find his ECGs. Now, when we found those ECGs, they went to a cardiologist who went, oh, they've got ST elevation and PR depression. He had pericarditis all along, even though the hospitals misdiagnosed him as having anxiety and sent him on his way. So the ECGs definitely proved that he had vaccine injury right from the start, and they disappeared. Then they found some of them, but one of them they haven't found. And then he had a referral from Nelson Hospital to a cardiologist through the public health system disappear as well. So there's, yeah, I've still got all these investigations underway, which I'll take through to the Privacy Commissioner if I have to.
I don't know how you lose that information. I had a heart thing a few years ago, and they were able to bring everything up right there when I was sitting there.
Yeah, well, they're not, by law, they actually have to keep your records for 10 years. So it's a privacy issue. It's a Privacy Commissioner issue complaint if they don't find that ECG from the day of the vaccine. Luckily for us, we found it in a different place. The ambulance one we found, and then they somehow miraculously found his ECG on an off hospital site somewhere in a record storage. So they found it, but not up digitally.
Okay, I want to bring Linda in now. So when you saw what came back to Ali from those OIAs, Linda,
yeah,
what did you see and what did you make of it? And we'll get to you guys shortly, so don't worry.
Well, I actually wasn't that surprised, to be honest. I was surprised that Ali had been given that data without too much struggle. But what we saw in the data was that there was a doubling of chest pain admissions from 2019 to 2020. So they went up from about 2,000 admissions to 4,000. But then in 2021, they just went mental. Mm. And I think it was, Ali, you'll have to correct me, I think it was 12 or 13,000 admissions in 2021. Went up again to 20-odd thousand in 22, settled at around the same level in 23. But the interesting thing is that here we are in 2024 and we're on track. Obviously, we've only got 6 months of data, but if we extrapolate out to a whole year, we're on track to have somewhere around 29 to 30,000 admissions for chest pain in 2024. So it just appears to be getting progressively worse each year from 2021 onwards.
That's like a nuclear bomb going off, isn't it?
Well, it is when you think that we're talking about, these are admissions under the age of 40. So we're talking about chest pain admissions for the healthiest, youngest demographic in New Zealand, the people that should never even be thinking about chest pain, not for a good 20 to 30 years on top of that.
Going from 2,000 in 2019 to we're on track for over 20,000 in 2024.
No, we're on track. We're on track. If we get the same number of admissions as we have in the first 6 months of 2024, we're on track for 29,000 admissions.
Oh, nearly 30,000.
Yeah, almost 30,000.
Guy, are these the stats we've been waiting for?
Oh, well, these are the stats we've been hoping would never happen. I mean, Ali, that your family's affected, my family's affected, you know, tens of thousands of families are affected all across New Zealand. And we've known this. And now we see it in black and white. We knew because of our friends and friends' families and so on that this was very widespread. But now it's admitted, it's open, it's in the open. The question is, will the government stonewall this or will they acknowledge it? And will the media stonewall it or will they acknowledge it? I don't know. I mean, this is extraordinary that they have had this information for all these years and they've hidden it. It's criminal. You know, it's no other word for it.
Ali, we're talking about just one, are we talking nationwide figures or just one area that is the area that your son presented in?
Oh, that my son presented in? The nationwide figures are the figures that are given in the OIA. And my son presented at Ashburton Hospital, Christchurch Hospital, then Lakes Hospital 3 days consecutively. And then he's been back into hospital with chest pain since then, ambulance in October, and he did Christmas and New Year's Eve 2022 as well. So about six visits in total, but he's under a cardiologist now and got good, you know, good level of care there.
Does the cardiologist realise what's happened?
Yeah, he's lucky enough to have a really good cardiologist. And yes, she has. And it was interesting. And he said, oh, you know, it's kind of, I know it's a controversial thing, to which her answer was, well, we're over that now. So, you know, I think there's a kind of a turnaround because there's just no way those cardiologists seeing that amount of young men can actually, you know, because it is predominantly young men, that they can turn their back on that. They can't. You know, they need to help their patients. Like my son's on colchicine now. I'm sitting in a class 5 truck, would you believe, on my way to Christchurch with him. And he, as long as he's on colchicine and anti-inflammatories, he's fine. He can't stop them though. If he stops them, it comes back.
Right. Okay. Now this newly released myocarditis pericarditis study, Linda, what can you tell us about that?
Okay, so just a few days ago, a New Zealand study that we have been waiting a long, long time to see was finally released. And I say we've been waiting a long, long time because the data collection for this study, which was really a survey, they call it a study, the data collection ended in October 2022. So we have waited almost 2 more years for the findings of this particular study that was commissioned by MedSafe, who are our drug regulator and who are in charge of CALM, the pharmacovigilance system in New Zealand. And what they did was they used 298 people over the age of 12 who had registered either myocarditis or pericarditis adverse events after Pfizer mRNA in New Zealand. They'd registered with MedSafe. So 298 people, and what they did was they basically completed a survey with each of them. Each of these people had been diagnosed with myocarditis or pericarditis or both, what's called myopericarditis. They did a survey 90 days after their diagnosis, and the idea was to find out how they were at the 90-day mark, given that we're all assured constantly that myocarditis and pericarditis are mild and self-limiting after, you know, the mRNA. So how were these people at 90 days? And they also asked them a lot of open-ended questions to try to discern themes in their experience of dealing with vaccine injury in New Zealand. I mean, we can talk about what they found. Would you like to know what they found?
Yeah. What did they find?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So remember that we're told that these conditions are mild and self-limiting, in spite of what Ali Cook has just been telling us about her son. Obviously, he's the only person in New Zealand because it's mild and self-limiting. He's the one unique anomaly. But wait, the survey suggests perhaps he isn't unique. So this is 90 days after diagnosis. They found that... got my little stats written down here. they found that at 90 days, almost 60% of the people had chest pain that was unresolved.
60%.
60%.
Okay, lock that in.
Yeah.
Lock that in, folks.
Yeah.
60%.
Yeah.
Okay.
54.4% still had severe fatigue. 41.3% still had shortness of breath. And when they say shortness of breath, you think, oh, well, you know, get a bit puffed going up a hill. No, no, no. This is getting up off the sofa and walking to put the kettle
like
on.
Struggling
and
to breathe.
Gasping
struggling.
To breathe. That's that yeah, kind of shortness okay. of breath, right? Palpitations at 90 days, 43.6% of people still had them. Dizziness, 27.9% of people. And 1.3% of people were still fainting as well. So that is not what I consider in people between the age of 12 and 40 who were previously going about their lives, just having normal lives, going to work, going to school, and suddenly 3 months after their diagnosis, they're totally incapacitated with all of these serious health issues ongoing.
And this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, my God.
Because it's enormously underdiagnosed. Lots of people suffering, and we know lots of people suffering these kind of symptoms who haven't, you know, who are just going about their lives and just, you know, have been sent away from the health system.
There must be other signals everywhere around as a result of this, and more, as you say, tip of the iceberg guy, must be showing up for the insurance industry now somehow. Disability must be. I mean, if we're going on those figures that we've heard, especially from Ali or from Linda.
Disability is rising, you know, around 8% every year. The number of people unable to work is rising by who are working age people is rising by about 8%. And that, of course, doesn't include the people who are struggling to keep going at work. This is people who've had to give up. And my information from the private insurance industry is that this has become a huge problem for them because many private insurers offer work income replacement in the event of illness. And, you know, it's become a problem and they're worried about it. This is sort of internal information released to me. I'm hoping to get more figures on this. It's absolutely unprecedented. It's a tsunami of injury affecting young people.
Tsunami, yeah, yeah. So, well, an immediate stop to these mRNA vaccinations needs to happen like this minute, it sounds.
Absolutely.
Do you think, folks?
100%. I mean, it needed to have stopped within the first 6 weeks of the rollout globally because, you know, 4 weeks afterwards, there were already hundreds of deaths in the American VAERS system. Yes, absolutely needs to stop here and now, but instead we're having between 4,500 and 5,500 new doses administered every week still in New Zealand.
There was a paper
also,
came out.
Yeah,
sorry. Go ahead, Ali.
Yeah, I just think it also needs to be mentioned that the ACC figures, that there's a graph there on ACC with some ACC figures that I sent through to you, Paul, and it shows this huge rise at 9 months plus from injury to lodgement. Now, my son, it took 2 years to get diagnosed, and he was dismissed as, you know, anxiety. You know, he was dismissed as it not being anything to do with the vaccine, even though he'd had the vaccine that morning of the ambulance. And it took 2 years to get to a cardiologist. And so there's a lot of people getting diagnosed. The majority of people diagnosed that they've paid out have come in 9 months or later, their lodgement for ACC after their injury. So there's this huge lag of people not diagnosed. I also did write after this OIA to the government, and they've all received that information that I got from the OIA, and I've asked for the end of the, you know, the vaccine rollout, basically, for them to stop it, because it's going to put such a strain on the health system that eventually it will just break, because there's all the people like my son who've been sick all the way along and are still sick, because 90 days is not it. You know, it's 2 years and 10 months for him. Yeah. And then there's all the people that are getting injured, as Linda said, from the 4,000 to 5,000 that are happening now every week. So it's like, this is not going to stop till they stop that shot.
Well, it won't stop. I think that what the government did was to try, and the health services, to try and suppress the long understanding that myo and pericarditis were very serious illnesses. You know, the 10-year mortality rate for people diagnosed with acute myocarditis or pericarditis is 25%. And it has a well-known progression. And so what the government did, right, and they waited a whole year after this massive rise in people coming in with chest pain before writing this really mild letter to the DHBs, saying, from Ashley, signed by Ashley Bloomfield, saying that, you know, the rate of cases was about 3 out of every 100,000 vaccinated, and you know, it was an issue, but that was it, sort of thing. It was a very mild letter. Keep a lookout for it. Well, they were keeping a lookout. They were getting hit in the face with it, and no one spoke up publicly to raise the alarm on this. They were suppressing everything, telling people. Some of my close family were sent home and told they were anxious and forget about it and so on. And this was repeated all across the
country.
Do
you think those were genuine opinions, or that was, you know, what we need to tell them if they turn up complaining in this way?
Well, you're talking about the health service, where, you know, vaccination is the kind of sacred cow. You can't say anything against
that. So it could never be that in those minds.
You'd lose your job.
Doctors were under a mandate, an information mandate from the medical council. I mean, NZDSOS have been in court the last 2 days fighting for doctors to have the right to give a fully informed consent process to people, no matter what the drug or the medical intervention is, including vaccines, because they were literally silenced by the medical council, which is one of the places that this massive, seemingly irreversible breach of trust has happened between the New Zealand population and the medical and health sector in New Zealand. There are just hundreds of thousands of us who no longer trust doctors or medicine, because we lived through this event, through the COVID years, where you couldn't have a personalised consultation with a personalised risk-benefit analysis and genuinely personalised medical advice from your doctor. They weren't allowed to do it. So NZDSOS are literally in court fighting for a ruling that will never happen again.
Sue Gray was on the program yesterday, and she's been observing that, and she said they had nothing. They had nothing. They had nothing of substance in that appearance, the medical council. Just saying.
Oh, the medical council.
Yeah,
right.
They had nothing, I think she said. Sorry, Guy, I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
Well, on September 6th, the New Zealand Medical Journal published a paper on COVID vaccine effectiveness. It's a long paper. It's full of interesting information. But in this entire paper, there's not a single mention of vaccine side effects. And that's what's happening in the medical system. Suppress the information. Don't mention it. Don't say anything. It's just defending themselves against criticism at this point, which is totally immoral, because all these young people are falling sick.
Well, it's more than criticism, isn't it? Now it's looking like, well, how would you describe this?
It's indescribable. Well, I mean, it's actually, you know, it's a staggering affront to your intellect to think that these people responsible for our health are hurting us and hiding the fact that they're hurting us.
And know that it's happened and keep it going.
Yeah, I think one of the things there, like, as a mother of a vaccine-injured son and who's gone through this, I actually hold the medical council accountable for a great deal of it, because when I look now, you know, 3 ECGs from 3 hospitals misread for ST elevation and PR depression, which should be detectable, you know, and like now a real cardiologist looks at that. That's 3 lots of doctors misdiagnosed my son when there were actually signs on the test results that showed he had pericarditis. So that's willfully misdiagnosing to make it go away. And I don't sort of blame the doctors because they are so scared because they could see other colleagues losing their licenses for as little things as making a video for young people to show them how to ask for informed consent.
Yeah, but you might be sending someone home to their death though, Ali.
Correct. They risked my son's life. And I won't stop until I see justice.
Sorry, Linda, go.
So I was just going to say, so it's great Ali's here talking about, you know, grassroots, real life lived experience on the ground, you know, mothering an adult son through this process of trying to be diagnosed and assess help and have it written on records that this is a vaccine injury and get ACC. And it is just a full-on nightmare. And this study that was commissioned by MedSafe, where they've sat on the data for 2 whole years while millions more doses of Pfizer mRNA have been administered in New Zealand, they're open-ended questions from these nearly 300 people, patients, open-ended questions that themes come through around well-being, the healthcare system, follow-up care and support, mandates and exemptions, follow-up advice and communications, ACC and information prior to receiving the vax. So these were the broad categories of themes. And what comes through, I was so furious when I read this. I've had steam coming out of my ears for 2 days since I read this study, because this has been my lived experience every minute of every day, interfacing with thousands of New Zealanders. They could have saved God knows how many million dollars with the study and just actually spoken to me, which is what I've been trying to get everybody's attention. I could have told them all of these themes. They're talking about the fact the themes are people have not recovered from myocarditis and pericarditis. It's impacted their well-being on all levels, physical, mental, emotional, family relationships, lifestyle and work. The healthcare system, the theme that's come through, gaslighted, dismissed, told I had anxiety, couldn't get a diagnosis, round and round in circles. Follow-up care and support, once they finally got the diagnosis, they were helpless. They couldn't access help. They couldn't see a cardiologist. Waiting lists were too long. It just goes on and on and on. They've known this for 2 years, and the final summary from MedSafe at the end is the fact that we need to develop better, more consistent, improved cooperation between health services and ACC. We need to ensure that there's more guidance and information materials on both the risks and the benefits communicated to both patients and doctors. We need to continue to expand our knowledge of rare and serious adverse events and guide clinical practice with the latest evidence, and we need to encourage reporting of adverse events to CALM. And they've sat on all of that while millions more doses were pushed into Kiwi arms for 2 years.
There are two words in there that should never have been in there. One was the word rare,
and
the other was the word benefits.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I don't see any benefits here.
Well, I noticed in the stuff that you got back, Ali, they referred to people who got the vaccines as consumers, like it was some, you know, I'm out at the supermarket buying something.
Yeah. Well, we're not out at the supermarket buying something. In my son's case, he was putting something into his arm that he didn't want to, but the only way for him to keep his job was to do that. So it was,
but it's another word that's kind of used. It's a sort of a deflective use of the word. It doesn't carry the gravitas that the reality.
It implies choice, doesn't it?
When
you're a consumer, you willingly buy into something. That's what it implies.
Yeah. There seems to be a lot of that. Okay, so we know about the heart stuff. We can assume then, Guy, we can assume that We will see blowouts in numbers then, if this is a thing, certainly looks like a thing, in other problem areas, cancer.
We're already
dementia, dementia and other conditions. We're already seeing it. Yep.
It just highlights, yes. And these figures are being hidden also. What we're seeing is a fundamental miscalculation that the Pfizer was very clever calling this a vaccine. It's a gene therapy. And the track record of this kind of intervention was well known in published literature before the pandemic. It carries serious whole system risks. And that's what we're seeing now. And that's the other side of the coin that's being hidden. The development of fast onset turbo, so-called turbo cancers, the problems with depression, and for older people, or even in some younger people as well, the increase in rates of dementia, because you're jumping in there and altering the immune system. The immune system carries out trillions of repairs every day in our physiology, trillions upon trillions, tens of thousands of trillions of repairs every day in our body, keeping us on track, keeping us safe from pathogens, from system failures. It's enormously complex. You're going right into the command and control system there, and you're altering what it does. And goodness, you know, the best analogy is a computer virus. We know that, you know, a computer virus, it can get into a network and it can collapse the whole system.
Yeah, take it down.
We have a network of cells. And what is happening is that we've got a so-called medical intervention that gets into that physiological network and changes the way it works. And it was predicted by very eminent people that this would be the result. And here we see the result. And how, you know, this was hubris on the part of the biotechnology sector, that they would suddenly commercialize something that they knew to be very unsafe, then not warn anyone. And then the medical profession accepting all this. And then they got on board, tried to hide it as well. So you see, I mean, you use the word conspiracy. What other word can you use?
Well, it fits the dictionary definition, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Totally. So coming up against time, obviously the next question is, if these shots haven't been stopped by now, why not? They know it. Yet you let it continue. I can't quite work that one out. I know hubris, all that, but you know, how could you let it go on?
I think you've got that expression. I know what is right, but I can't do it. I know what is wrong, but I can't refrain from it. And, you know, every addict will understand what I'm saying here. And what you have is a medical system who've become addicted to a point of view to the extent that they now know, they're beginning to realize it's wrong, at least in some cases, but they can't refrain from it. It's what they've done all their life. It's what they've been trained to do. It's what they've been brainwashed into believing. And they're just going to go on to the sort of bloody.
Yeah, but there's so many other sectors. You know, I know a lot about, you know, flying and that. If there's anything wrong with an aircraft, they ground it. They ground the entire fleet worldwide. Not next week. Now. Nothing takes off anymore. That's what happens. Because people might die.
I have a theory, and I think it's all based around the Pfizer contract. If you look at the 6 leaked contracts, and well, South Africa's has been released through a court case, Canada's has now been released a couple of weeks ago, all of the clauses match. So you can maybe sort of surmise from that ours looks pretty much the same as everybody else's. And clause 8.1 says that the purchaser, who's the person who signed it, who in our case is the government and Grant Robertson, they basically signed to uphold Pfizer-BioNTech as harmless. Now, if they do anything but that, they've breached the contract, the purchase contract. So I think that's one of the main reasons. I'm taking a rough guess on that. And then you've got a thing called a sovereign waiver, as I think it's clause 9.4 in the, all of the contracts that have been leaked, which basically says that a sovereign waiver says that you can take the purchase at a court in an overseas court and that you can actually seize assets. So I reckon there's some pretty serious stuff in the Pfizer contracts. And the only way, when you look at the Pfizer contracts that are being taken, like right now in some of the states of the US, Kansas, etc., they're actually doing, they're doing them over the contract. They're saying you made false claims that your product worked when it didn't. So, and it caused
fraud,
harm,
isn't it?
But more that it didn't work.
That comes under fraud.
Yeah, so that's fraud. So then they can take the contract. So I feel that the only way is to convince the government to actually go Pfizer over the contract. Well, that's my theory anyway. I might be wrong, but I'm certainly not wrong about what's written in those leaked contracts, put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Good point, Sally. I just want to add something, you know, talking about this question of why is it not being stopped? Why have we not had an edict from on high stopping it all? What's happening on the ground? I get several reports from people, phone calls or messages every week now, from people who have had an interface with the medical system. They've been in an ambulance or they've been in ED or they've been to a cardiologist. And these people are contacting me to say, well, we shut the door, took the case history, asked me if I'd had the Pfizer vaccine. I said yes. And they leant forward and said, quietly, don't have any more, okay?
Yeah, well, that tells you everything you need to know.
So behind closed doors, what they're doing is they're putting a bob each way. They're keeping their job by not going to the head of the hospital or standing on a street corner or writing on social media. They're keeping their job, but they're quietly one-on-one telling their patients not to touch the product anymore.
Yeah, yeah. All right, anyone with any final words, things to say before we end this? Well, it's been a panel, really. Ali, you were first. You can go first on this too.
Final thoughts, a huge thanks to Guy Hatchard for covering, you know, for analysing with his expertise my OIA. And as I get more answers back, Guy, I'll certainly flick them through to you. And to Linda Forden, you are an angel upon this planet. What you have done for people like my son and many who are far worse off, I could never thank you enough. Thank God for you, Linda, that you've helped
these
people from the very start. I can never be grateful enough. And to you, RCR and Paul, for getting it out there, for getting the truth out there. I believe eventually the dam will break. It'll just become so big that they won't be able to keep their finger in the dike anymore, so to speak, and it will bust, you know. So, yeah, that's my final thoughts.
Linda.
Well, my final thoughts are like Ali's, that it's the bobbing cork syndrome, and right now there are so many corks bobbing to the surface in every direction that they're impossible to push down all at the same time. Truth is coming. Even Fortress New Zealand is going to break at some point, and this is going to become a mainstream conversation. I'm very hopeful and anticipating that phase two of the Royal Commission of Inquiry will be the catalyst for, you know, an insurmountable number of corks popping to the surface and everybody in New Zealand knowing what's happened, basically. So keep the pressure on now. We're all weary, but now is not the time to stop. We're close to the finish line.
Guy.
Oh, I'd like to be optimistic, but actually I know that there are hundreds of mRNA vaccines of all sorts of different types being developed, some of which are just starting to be trialled here in New Zealand. This is something very specific that we've dealt with. It's the effect of a single vaccine on a population, and it's been horrific. But I think everyone has to realize this is much broader than this. This is a complete shift in the approach of the pharmaceutical medical complex and its relationship with the population, and it's a shift towards biotechnology. So I'm finally asking, why is our government deregulating biotechnology?
Yeah. Okay, I want to thank Ali Cook. Thank you, Ali, for sharing your story and doing the work that you've done. It's incredible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Linda, well, I don't need to say much more than I've already said to you, so thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Paul. Been great to be here.
And as always, Guy, thank you.
Thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.